Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the church today.
Hello and welcome to the Lutheran Inquisitor. I'm your host, John Ehlers. I'm pastor of Christ Lutheran Church in Orpington, Kent, a southeastern suburb of London. I'd like to take this opportunity to invite you to join us for one of our services. We meet each Sunday at 10:30 a.m. or Wednesday evenings at 7 p.m. for Vespers. Please do come along. I know you'll receive a warm welcome. Check us out on our Facebook page, which is Christ Lutheran Church UK. I also, along with Pastor Wade Bellisbach, serve the saints at St. Columba Lutheran Church in East Kilbride. We also work with the Edinburgh Mission and the St. Andrew's Mission. St. Columba meets each Sunday morning at 11 a.m., and you can find out more details about us on our website, along with all the other congregations in the LCE, lutheran.co.uk. Click on the directory button and find the congregation that's closest to you. Go and pay them a visit. I know you'll be blessed. I'd also like to thank you for your prayerful and your financial support of Lutheran Radio, for without your prayers and your gifts, we wouldn't be able to carry on this ministry, and we are deeply grateful to you. Today, we are very pleased to welcome Dr. Carter Lindbergh. He is Professor Emeritus of Church History at Boston University's School of Theology. He is the author and editor of numerous books and articles. Two of his most popular would be The European Reformation and Beyond Charity. Dr. Lindbergh, it's a real pleasure and honor to have you with us. In your book, you talk about the approaches to poverty and the poor between the years 1300 and 1600 AD. Why is this such an important time period to look at for particularly the church's approach to dealing with the poor and the poverty-stricken?
Well, I think that by that time, there was growing cities and urbanization and the beginning of a capitalist economy, so that the social and economic situation is changing quite a bit. And the older understandings of poverty and the poor no longer fit. Well, so there are increasing social issues at this time.
And you mentioned the poverty or the poor. How would you define those terms?
In the early church and the Middle Ages, the term poor has a number of different meanings. So theologically, there was an effort to describe it as humility, for example. The Magnificat speaks of Mary's humility rather than her poverty. And it also means powerless in terms of the different social classes. And it tended to be, initially it's for the early church, there is this taking quite seriously, almost literally, the sense that one should naked follow the naked Christ, that there should be a kind of discipleship that you find as an effort to develop the Jesus saying to the rich young ruler, you know, who says, how can I be saved? Well, you can be saved by selling everything you have, giving it to the poor, and following me. So there is a fairly widespread ascetic movement in the early church, but then the church begins to attract people with more wealth who are coming into the church, and the question arises, well now, if they're not giving up everything, how may they be saved? And you find some famous sermons like Clement of Alexandria, trying to address this. And one of the answers is, well, you can distribute your wealth, you can give charity, and in terms of old apocryphal writings, like Tobit and Ecclesiasticus, almsgiving atones for sin. If you give alms, if you give to the poor, this will save you from sin and even from death. So there is this romanticization of the poor as those who are marginal, but are vehicles, as St. Augustine would say, for carrying your treasure to heaven. But this begins to change as you move through the centuries, and there are more and more poor people, and they begin, the poor themselves, some of which recognize, oh, well, we can just accept alms and somehow get by. So there are a variety of social and theological issues that arise in terms of both the definition of poverty as a social status, but then as an economic status. And if poverty is the ideal Christian life, how are rich people, or middle class people, if you will, to somehow satisfy this requirement themselves? So they put it on, they make the poor the bearers of their salvation in a way.
And indeed, you mentioned in your book that there are several sort of classes of poor, the unworthy poor and the worthy poor. What do you mean by the worthy poor and the unworthy poor?
The unworthy poor are those who accept your alms. They are, in terms of some of the literature of the time, they are not humble. They are actually manipulating you to get some kind of income. They're beggars. There's a great deal of beggar literature by the centuries just before Luther, by this period around 1300. There are whole books that describe the various tricks that people will use to get alms. And some of these are pretty bizarre. So there is an effort to expose those who are the unworthy poor, that is, those who are trying to embezzle heaven, so to speak, who are trying to get your alms, and those who are actually really destitute for a variety of reasons. They're orphans, they are unemployable, they are ill. So there is a distinction that's going on by the late Middle Ages. You don't want to give your alms to those who are unworthy. You want to give them to those who will carry your alms up to heaven for you.
Yeah, and you mentioned that this almsgiving is seen as providing forgiveness and life. And it was kind of exacerbated by the church as well with its sort of mendicant movements. So you received forgiveness by giving alms, and did the recipient sort of receive forgiveness by receiving those alms? Did both sort of have their place within the scheme of salvation as seen in the church at that time?
The recipient of alms, in the theoretical framework, who is a worthy poor person, is in and of himself, is sort of intrinsically worthy of heaven, will be redeemed. So the big issue is for those who are wealthy in terms of power, or finances, as to how they will receive salvation, since the kind of biblical mantras that were being used spoke about the value of poverty.
How does then the development of these mendicant orders play into this view of poverty and the poor being worthy and the rich needing to earn their merit to receive heaven?
There are two major mendicant orders initially in this time period, the Dominicans and the Franciscans. And the Dominicans are a response. Dominic is responding to heretical movements of the time, the Cathari and the Waldenses, who are so emphasizing poverty and humility that they have a heretical stance toward creation itself. And they have an extremely ascetic life. So Dominic tries to respond to this and takes on a lifestyle comparable to these heretical movements, but is more orthodox. Francis himself comes out of an early capitalist context. His father is well-to-do. And he then decides he moves to a situation in which he will embrace poverty itself. He wants to become so holy by becoming extremely marginal economically and poor. And of course, the major thing is being poor in spirit, being humble. The ironic thing is that the Franciscans, these mendicants, that is, they are friars. They are not contained within monastic communities, but they go out into the early urban areas and preach on the street corners and encounter people everywhere and provide a lifestyle that supposedly could be emulated, but who wants to do that? Who then become the vehicles or the channels for the wealthier people to provide for the poor. That is, by donating to, say, the Franciscans, you don't have to deal with the poor yourself. And in the artwork of the time, you find the donor off to one side and Francis in the middle, and the donor gives the money to Francis, and Francis gives the goods to the poor people. So you don't have to deal with the poor people yourself. Francis will be the intermediary for you. So that makes life a little easier. So these movements become vehicles for, you know, salving the conscience of people and providing for wealthier people and providing avenues for salvation. That's kind of interesting. Francis himself becomes the patron saint of merchants. So the person who himself embraces extreme poverty is seen to be a really worthy character for the early capitalist movement.
You've alluded to it just then and also earlier, but often the poor at the start of this time period were in the country. At this later stage of the time period you're talking about, the 16th century, we see the development of cities and larger towns. What effect did the poor moving from the countryside into the cities and towns have upon how they were viewed and how they were dealt with by society, and particularly the church?
In the earlier, more rural context, you would know who your neighbor is, and you would have some kind of sense of their needs, and you would have various means, either through the church or monastic communities, to try to address these needs. But as the cities develop, you have a larger population, you have increasing anonymity, and you have increasing difficulties for obtaining an income and housing and jobs and this sort of thing. So the town councils and the people who are running these cities or attempting to provide some sort of basic government of the cities find that growing poverty is a social issue, and they're struggling to know how to deal with that.
And you note that it is sort of into this situation that Luther steps onto the stage of history. And one of the things I found fascinating is you talked about how the church was set up on, you know, you get merit by helping the poor. But Luther comes in and you state Luther's understanding of the poor and his understanding of poverty is not based on merit, but it's based on worship, on how it relates to the divine service. Did I read that correctly? And what do you mean by that?
That's a good question that we could spend a few weeks discussing. But essentially, Luther understands himself primarily as a pastor and theologian, not as a social reformer. So the jumping off point or the orientation for Luther is his understanding of the relationship with God, which in terms of his biblical studies, he comes to see not in the medieval terms of a covenant, which is a legal and then theological religious orientation in which God is primarily the primary actor who sets up the covenant. But you're responsible for carrying out the will of God. And so one of the scholastic phrases for this is faith formed by charity. And here you get this sense that, well, giving alms, etc., charity is a way in which your faith is formed and which your faith grows and you become closer and you mount closer and closer to heaven. One of the very central images of the medieval period is the ladder image. And so you have all these pictures of people mounting the rungs of the ladder, and the person at the very top is called charity and receives the crown of life from God. In the meantime, you know, you're starting at the bottom and you're climbing up a rung, and you get tempted by this, that, and the other thing, and devils knock you off the ladder and angels try to get you back. But anyway, it's a whole image of a kind of covenant relationship. I mean, you could speak about this also in terms of a Deuteronomic view of history. If you keep the covenant, you will be rewarded. Your life will be long in the land that God has given you. If you don't keep the covenant, you're in serious trouble. And so that's why you have the book of Job to kind of respond to that. Well, I kept the covenant. Look what happened to me. So Luther grows up in a scholastic development of this kind of covenant theology, that your faith is formed by charity. And he comes to see what we can call a testament view of salvation, that God chooses you. This is the burden of proof for your salvation is on God, not on you. And so he really runs with the passage in Hebrews about the Testament, and in his own colorful way, he can say, look, if you're named in God's last will and testament, if you're named as the heir, no matter what kind of person you are, no matter how, I think he puts it, you know, scabby and stinky and dirty you are, if you show up at the lawyer's office and say, look, I'm written in God's will, and God has died to make the will effective, you have to give it to me. In other words, the burden of proof for salvation is on God, and not on you. And so, this for Luther is incredibly liberating. Also obviously for many of his contemporaries who pick up on this. And so, that frees, that kind of, some people have called it a Copernican revolution in theology, that kind of shift in thinking means, oh, I can look at social issues differently than I have before. Poverty is not a virtue. It's kind of a bad scene that we need to try to address and make better. And so he sees this just in terms of the Eucharist. And again, the artwork of the time, if you take a look at the major triptych in the Wittenberg Church, the image of the Lord's Supper, it's a circle, and it's open to the congregation. That is, you no longer, are, as in the earlier artwork, see the back of a priest at the far end of a church sacrificing the Mass, but you now, with Lucas Cranach's painting, altar work, you see a communion, and it is so presented that the church is drawn into this, and Luther will make a play on words here, in which he says, the German word for worship is Gottesdienst, and he'll turn that around and he'll say, well, Dienst Gottes, that is, service to God, is service to your neighbor, and he ties this in with worship itself.
How does this understanding of the Eucharist differ from what the Roman Church had been understanding the Eucharist to be? And how does that affect the social ethic?
So, for Luther, this sacrament is God's promise to the people. So it's an empowering effort. It's an empowerment to serve the neighbor, because you are now served and you are incorporated into God's love. It is in contrast to at least the distortions of the Eucharist in the late medieval context. This is not some good work that will somehow accrue to the account book of the beyond, to some kind of economic list of your assets, but it is rather that you are now given, and so you may give to others freely.
Dr. Lindberg, thank you very much for these very interesting words on Luther's understanding of how we serve others and why we serve others, and how he sees that differently than the medieval church. Unfortunately, we're out of time, so we'd like to invite you back next week to carry on this conversation, and we would invite our listeners back to join us then as well.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.